Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Delaware is home to its fair share of small towns and villages.
There are 29 towns and villages in Delaware with a population of 1,200 people or less.
Contributor Larry Nagengast examines how they survive and thrive despite their size. Horace Pippin was one of the first African-American painters to earn national recognition in his lifetime. Nearly 70 years after his death, Pippin's art still resonates.
We see scenes of the war. We see scenes of racism, social commentary on other issues, such as slavery and religion. And I think that all those things are still relevant today.
In our arts playlist, we travel to the Brandywine River Museum of Art to preview its new exhibition, Horace Pippin, The Way I See It. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We'll also meet a UD researcher using the Hubble Space Telescope and check in on the Rehoboth Art League's expansion. Plus, this month's History Matters. The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground, is next. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The first state map is dotted with small towns with tiny populations and budgets, but fairly long histories. They range from Bellefonte, where 1,193 residents, myself included, just celebrated the town's 100th anniversary, to Hartley, population 74, that is trying to reorganize after its town government nearly fell apart recently. In all, there are 29 towns and villages in Delaware with populations under 1,200 people. And we asked contributor Larry Nagengast to look into how they operate and why. His piece on small town Delaware is available now at DelawarePublic.org, and he sat down with me this week to discuss what he found during his survey of these mini municipalities.
Based on their size, I mean, what are they actually able to provide as a government for their residents?
Well, in most cases, not very much. You take a town like Bethel, whose population is, it's 171. The big item on their budget is streetlights, and they also plow the roads when it snows. That's about it. The town of Bethel has a budget in the neighborhood of $30,000 for the year.
And there are some that are a little bit more robust, though, in terms of their budget and size and what they can do.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And some of the more robust communities might have a budget in the neighborhood of, I'm trying to recall, I think Newport has a budget in the neighborhood of $1.5 million. And I think Bridgeville is in the same vicinity. Both of those towns, about half of their budget, maybe a little bit more, goes for the town police force. And then the rest of it is for office staff, which is usually just a couple of people at most. And then you get into street lights and basic road maintenance, that sort of thing.
Some of them do rely on the county that they are located in for some of the other services, correct?
Yes, absolutely they do. Certainly we're familiar in Newcastle County anyway with the smaller towns, whether it's Bellefonte or whether it's the Ardens. If they don't have a police force, they rely on Newcastle County for their policing services. They'll also for things like building code violations, that's the property code. There's a lot of things that the town doesn't do that essentially gets deferred to the county government.
Given that, why not just be absorbed by the county? Why remain separate?
Really, what it comes down to is the issue of self-determination. People like to be able to make their own decisions for themselves. Glenn Govrey, the mayor of Little Creek, said, well, gee, if we were unincorporated, the folks in Kent County government might just as well decide to roll us into Dover. What does that do for a town that's got 225 people? The sense of self-determination is strong, wanting to maintain the heritage, the sense of community that has been developed over the years. Lipsick and Little Creek, for instance, are towns that have a bit of a maritime history, and they want to keep and preserve that. Bellefonte, which celebrated its 100th anniversary this year, has that small town feel. It's really one street that has a little bit of commercial on it, and a lot of resale shops and a couple of restaurants. But there's a special feel feel that these small communities have. And when you have control of your own destiny, you're able to plan what your town is going to be like. That's really important to the residents.
You mentioned Hartley and the issues that they've had. Is that the biggest challenge for these towns, is actually just kind of maintaining the structure of government over the course of, you know, year after year after year?
I wouldn't say that it's the biggest challenge, but it's certainly a significant issue in many cases. In Hartley's case, approximately 3 years ago, a majority of the town council just stopped showing up and resigned their positions, and then there was no town council, nobody to send out the bills, nobody to collect the taxes, nobody to apply to the state for grants, and so on. And now they've just reorganized, and five people filed for the town council, and they've told the State Board of Election that they now have a council, and they're moving forward on reorganizing. And it's similar situations in many other towns. Not so much that they don't have a government, but Bellefonte's a pretty stable community, and yet it hasn't been unusual for them to be short one member of the five-member council. Either nobody wants to run, or during the course of the year, somebody has a job change, a transfer, something else comes up, and they have to resign and find somebody else. So, finding the five members is an issue. In some cases, the folks who are there are doing a good job. They like the work, and they kind of stay in there year after year after year. And then you get the issue of, are we ever going to get any sort of change in the community as well? Because it's good to bring some new voices in from time to time, too.
And you mentioned the idea of change. I mean, these towns are planning ahead. I mean, there is a requirement for them to do these kind of plans for the future, correct?
Absolutely. About 15 years ago, there was a state law that was passed that required all municipalities to come up with a comprehensive plan. And now the rule is that every 10 years, the plan has to be updated. And every 5 years, there has to be a review made. So, in case there's a need to make any changes in between. The folks that I talked to and several of the towns point out that having this plan is very important. It's a way of enabling you to preserve your heritage. It's a way to be able to decide where you want to go in the future. If you don't have a plan, and you don't have a framework for your growth, how you want the town to change, somebody can come in with a proposal for land use in a particular part of your community, They may very easily be able to get a rezoning or authorization to build something that the folks in the community don't like, because there wasn't a framework laid out that spells out, here are the goals, here are the objectives, here's what we want our town to look like in the future.
Given all this, I mean, they do seem, most of these towns, to operate fairly well. Correct?
I would say yes. They operate fairly well with the limited amount of resources that they have. I mean, in the planning process, for instance, small towns don't have planners, but they do call on the Office of State Planning Coordination, and that office's roles is to send out people from the Department of Transportation, from Natural Resources, from Historical Preservation, to meet with the members of the town, of the community, to discuss particular aspects of the plan. Many of the towns that have larger budgets will have a town clerk or a town manager who tends to be a jack of all trades, doing everything from meeting with state agencies to opening the mail, and literally everything, ranging from mosquito control, whatever else has to be done, the garbage collection contracts. It devolves onto one or two people to take care of that, and they do seem to manage pretty well. Some of the folks say that if nobody shows up at the town council meeting, that probably means that we're doing all right. They're not, there's no big issue in town. And a lot of the towns, there are other places that, even if there's not much activity at the town council meetings, there are things like the fire halls, the church groups, and so on, where members of the community stay active, and they've got a way of hanging together. together.
Having said all that, do you think these towns have a long-term future?
I'm going to say yes. Yes, I do. The examples of towns like Hartley are exceptionally rare. I do kind of wonder. I think we all have to wonder, you know, if you've got 75 people in a town, you know, whether it's worth the, you know, the cost and the expense of you know, maintaining that separate government. Gee, you know, if 75 people in Hartley and a 5-member commission, gee, that, you know, that's like 6% of the town or whatever is, you know, right there directly involved in town government. It's a challenge, you know, for some of them. But I've got a feeling that you know, pretty much all of them are going to endure in some fashion.
Our thanks to contributor Larry Nagengast for his time. His piece on small town Delaware is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. Next up on The Green, as the Hubble Space Telescope celebrates its 25th anniversary, we talk to a UD researcher using it to study dying stars or white dwarfs. This is Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. For astronomers, booking time with the Hubble Space Telescope can be a lot like trying to reserve a table at a high-end restaurant. But in the last couple of years, Judy Provenshaw, an astronomer at the University of Delaware, has been lucky enough to book a few orbits with the Hubble, which just reached its 25th birthday. She studies white dwarfs, or dying stars, to understand what happens to a star at the end of its life and what the future might hold for our own sun. Delaware Public Media science reporter Eli Chen spoke with Provenshaw about what telescopes like the Hubble are able to reveal about white dwarfs.
So, Dr. Provenshaw, what are the big questions that you try to answer about white dwarfs, and how does the Hubble answer them?
Well, a white dwarf star is a star that's at the end of its life. It used to be a star like the sun, but it's run out of nuclear fuel, and so it shed all of its outer atmosphere, and all you're left with is just the core of a star. And what we're trying to answer is, how did this star get to where it is now? The sun right now is forming a white dwarf in its center. Right now the sun is taking hydrogen atoms and turning them into helium. And when it gets a little bit older, it's going to take helium and turn it into carbon. And then when it gets to carbon, it can't go any further than that. And at that point, the sun is actually going to form a white dwarf. So we're using the white dwarfs that exist now, and it's kind of like doing forensic astronomy. You know, you're digging around inside the guts of these dead stars, trying to figure out what they ate for lunch. And so that's what we're doing with the white dwarfs. We're trying to figure out exactly how stars like the sun end up there and how long it takes them to get there, and if there's more than one way to form a white dwarf, or if do they all go exactly the same through exactly the same path or not, we don't know. And so that's what we're trying to find out. And the particular white dwarfs that I study are pulsating white dwarfs, which means they're changing their brightness over time. So if you sit there and you watch a white dwarf, which is what I do, I take lots of pictures of them, you can tell that the thing is getting brighter and dimmer and brighter and dimmer over time. And the periods for pulsating white dwarfs is about 10 minutes, so it's kind of fun to watch during the night. But what we do is we look at exactly how the stars are pulsating, and we can use that information to figure out what's going on inside the star. You can think about the idea of a bell, and if you ring a bell, it makes a certain noise. And imagine having a row of bell ringers, and everybody has a bell with a different tone. And the tone comes from the shape of the bell or from the metal that the bell is made of. So stars, in general, do the same thing. How they pulsate, how they ring, depends on what they're made of inside.
Ah, that's really interesting. And how much do you know about what's inside of white dwarfs?
We know more than we used to, which is it's a gratifying thing. But what I've found, too, is that as my career goes on, is that you know, the more things we find out about the white dwarfs, the more questions. So there's no end to this, which is good because I need a job.
Right. Well, actually, I want to get into the tools that you use to study white dwarfs. And I know back in a couple of years ago, you were able to, you know, book time with the Hubble telescope, which is not an easy appointment to book.
No.
So what did you study during, you know, the time? How long did you have the Hubble telescope for, and, you know, what did you use that time to do?
Well, Hubble runs a little bit differently than a normal telescope. For a normal telescope, you know, they assign you a week. You have this from this date to this date. But with Hubble, what you do is you say, okay, here's my list of target stars that I want to observe. And Hubble gives you telescope time in terms of orbits instead of nights. So I had something like 19 or 20 orbits on the telescope, and they don't give it to you all at once. They give it to you, you know, depending on other people's targets. They try to make a list to use the telescope as efficiently as possible because you don't want it just sitting up there doing nothing.
Right.
So I had observations going on all over the last 2 years. You know, every once in a while they would send me observations of a star that was on my target list. And what we were doing was we were using the ultraviolet light, which is a short wavelength light that you cannot see from the ground. And white dwarfs tend to be a little bit warm. And the particular ones I'm looking at are around 20,000 to 30,000 degrees Kelvin. So if you want to compare that to the sun is about 5,000 or 5,500 degrees Kelvin. So they're a little bit warmer than the sun. And most of their energy is radiated in the ultraviolet rather than the visible, like the sun. So we're trying to figure out exactly how hot these stars are. We don't really know. From the ground, you can get a temperature, but you have errors of up to 3,000 degrees. So you really don't know the temperature of these stars. So with Hubble, we were hoping to get errors down around, you know, a couple hundred degrees instead of 3,000.
Yeah, that's a lot to be off by.
Yeah, it's a lot to be off by. If you're off, you know, if your star is 20,000 plus or minus 3,000, you really don't know. So we had a list of 6 targets that we observed over time, and we have temperatures now for those 6, which are good to about 300 or 400 degrees. So we're pretty pleased with the observations that we got.
Right, and what were you able to learn from those targets?
Well, what we're trying to do is we're looking at exactly how the star is processing the energy that's coming through its interior and being radiated at the surface. And how we can see that at the surface is in the pulsations. If you're sitting there and you're watching the star pulsate, it'll get bright and dim and bright and dim. But if it's a star that has energy coming out in a way that's called convection, what happens is the star gets really bright, fast, and it goes down kind of fast. So it has a really high, narrow peak when it gets bright, and then it has a shallow valley. And so what we do, this is with ground-based observations, we measure how fast the thing gets bright and then how long it stays kind of dim. And that gives us an estimate of how the surface layers of the star are processing energy. And what we need to do to really understand that information is to know the temperature of the star. So with Hubble, we go off and measure the energy that the star is putting out at all different wavelengths. And what we try to find is where is it putting out the most energy? And if you find that maximum wavelength, then you can get a really good temperature for the star. And so that's what we did with our 6 targets. And I actually have a proposal in right now for a few more. So I'm waiting to hear if we get to do some more.
Right. So is it true that white dwarfs are being used to determine the age of galaxies?
Yes, that's a fun thing that you can do. Because a white dwarf, it has no nuclear fusion. It's just sitting there. It's like a big brick out in space. And it's just sitting there cooling off. And so what we've done is we've looked around in the galaxy for the coolest white dwarfs that we could find. And the ones that we found are about 3,000 degrees. So what you can do is you say, okay, here I have my white dwarf. It's 3,000 degrees. We think that when they form, they're like 100,000 degrees. And so how long does it take for the star to cool down from 100,000 degrees to 3,000 degrees? And that turns out to be about 9 or 10 billion years. And so we know if there were cooler white dwarfs than that, we should be able to find them. We have the technology now. We have pretty good astronomy. And they're not there. So that means that there aren't any stars that are older than that. And so that gives us an age of the disk, of the galactic disk for the Milky Way, of about 9 to 10 billion years. So that's kind of a fun thing to do.
Yeah, that's really amazing. So the successor of the Hubble telescope will launch in 2018, the James Webb Telescope.
Yes.
How will that aid your research in white dwarfs?
Oh, unfortunately, it's not going to do much because the James Webb does not look at ultraviolet light, which is kind of a sad thing. It's mostly an infrared telescope. It is exactly an infrared telescope. It's not mostly. It's an infrared telescope, which means it looks at long wavelength light. And it's a bad thing for white dwarfs, but it's a good thing for other types of astronomy, because what they're interested in mostly is looking for the very first stars. They're looking at stuff way out at the edge of the universe. And the best place to look for that is in the infrared light. And so, unfortunately, they're not going to help the white dwarfs very much, but they're going to be great. The web is going to be great for other aspects of astronomy.
Thanks to our Eli Chen and UD's Judy Provenshaw for their time this week. Stay with us. This month's History Matters is up next. But first, the latest news from Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green. I'm Tom Byrne. In this month's History Matters, our Anne Hoffman examines a University of Delaware interdisciplinary academic project called Colored Conventions. It's an effort to digitize the minutes of the nation's first black meetings, conventions which took place from 1830 until after the Civil War. These minutes provide a glimpse into black leadership and life that has traditionally been hard to access. And just last weekend, there was a symposium at UD that brought together several different academics who study race, literature, and American history to talk about it.
Dr. Gabrielle Foreman and her graduate students, Jim Casey and Sarah Patterson, created an online archive that highlights early black organizing.
The Color Conventions Project is a digital humanities project that brings buried 19th century African American history to digital life for large audiences.
In the 1800s, delegates met in national and local conventions to discuss a plethora of issues that worried and mobilized them. Issues like education, legal restrictions on black populations, and labor. Up to 2,000 people could be in attendance. Many of the meetings were held in African Methodist Episcopal churches and Baptist houses of worship. The first convention took place in Philadelphia in 1830, and the last one happened in Macon, Georgia in 1888. The movement began when a group of around 1,000 black people traveled from Ohio to Canada after facing violence from the local community. In Canada, planning began for the first convention.
It's this, again, a wide swath of communication in the 1830s, right? That allowed people in Philadelphia to say, we've got to address the violence against African-American communities. And delegates were chosen from local communities, so they represented those local churches, those local organizations, those local literary societies, all things that have been documented by scholars of the 19th century of late.
The meetings were open to the public and posted about beforehand in newspapers. All that is left from these meetings today are their written minutes. But Foreman says historians and the public can deduce quite a lot from those records. A notable convention took place in Delaware in 1873.
The 1873 Delaware Convention is an educational convention. It speaks about educational injustice, the ways in which African Americans pay taxes but don't have access to schooling, to schools, to public schooling.
An exhibit on that particular convention is in the works, but no other scholars had written about the Delaware Convention until the Delaware Historical Society brought it to Dr. Foreman's attention. Even though famous abolitionist and writer Frederick Douglass spoke at several conventions, and the grandfathers of Langston Hughes and W.E.B. Du Bois were delegates, Foreman says the movement has remained fairly invisible in popular history.
And it's a hidden movement that hasn't reached the kind of predominance, the kind of stature that the abolitionist movement and the anti-slavery and Underground Railroad movement has. One of the reasons we might argue that that is the case is because there's an interracial partnership both in the abolitionist movement and in the Underground Railroad movement, which sometimes gets represented as white allies and supporters who, through noblesse oblige and the largesse of their generosity, helped victims. But the Color Conventions movement really highlights black agency, black leadership, black organizational power, and the issues that it highlights are issues that continue today.
Although the movement has struggled to find a place in history books, the conventions made things happen. In Mobile, Alabama, for example, delegates helped form Talladega College. Other conventions worked to gather crucial population data.
They reported out census-like data before censuses were taking data on African Americans. So we have, for example, charts and graphs that highlight the black occupations. We know about barbering. We know about preaching. We know about a select number of black occupations, but the breadth and the width of the work that was being done, the labor that was being done, is really pretty breathtaking.
Now, Dr. Forman's graduate students and undergraduate students are trying to illustrate these early data gathering techniques through charts and graphs. Forman says echoes of these minutes can be heard in the sociopolitical discourse of today. She says one can see antecedents of the Black Lives Matter movement in conversations of convention goers who were concerned about police presence and legal constrictions on African Americans. The Colored Conventions Project engages undergraduates as well to create pages about certain historically overlooked people of color whose presence impacted the social landscape of the time. Elizabeth Gloucester, for example, was one of the richest women in the 19th century, but she's a little-known figure. At last week's convention, an entire presentation was devoted to her life and influence. And while many of the minutes are still in the process of being transcribed by members of the AME Church and other community stakeholders, the Colored Conventions Project is working to make all the information they've gathered fully searchable.
Transcribes Minutes is one of the initiatives of the project. What it does, it allows us to have the minutes that we have listed to be fully searchable. So if you're interested in, let's say, an ancestor or a historic figure, you would be able to search through all of the minutes that we have put up in order to find that history. Or if you're interested in a building, for example, or music, or how song is connected, or how hymns are connected to the Colored Conventions Project, you can search for those things.
Colored Conventions is also creating a church curriculum, resources for schools, and looking to further their partnerships with national organizations. Ultimately, the project's huge database has the potential to enable a multitude of people to understand Black history in a different way. But perhaps the most important mission of the project is offering historical context, showing that Black organizing and activism dates back to a time when slavery was still legal in the United States. For Delaware Public Media, I'm Ann Hoffman.
Thanks, Ann. You can see an extended video version of this History Matters, produced by Carl Malgiro, online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Next on The Green, our arts playlist takes us to the Brandywine River Museum of Art to learn about its new exhibit. This is Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green. I'm Tom Byrne. Horace Pippin was among the first African-American painters to earn national recognition in his lifetime. His paintings of history, war, and family life in Westchester, PA are all the more remarkable given his limited use of his right arm. Pippin was shot in the right shoulder during World War I. To paint, he used his left hand to support his right. Although Pippin didn't paint in earnest until he returned from the war, his artistic talents were visible early. He was 10 years old when he won a box of crayons in a local art contest. In our arts playlist, Delaware Public Media's Kathy Carter chats with Brandywine River Museum of Art Associate Curator Audrey Lewis about its new exhibit, Horace Pippin, The Way I See It.
Audrey, what is the connection that Horace Pippin has with the Brandywine Valley?
Well, he was born in Westchester, and he left Westchester at the age of 3 with his family. They moved to Goshen, New York, but he returned in 1920 when he married Jenny Ora Featherstone. And they settled in Westchester and stayed there for the rest of his life.
And Pippin's work was actually first championed by N.C. Wyeth, who, of course, has a huge connection to the Brandywine River Museum of Art. Tell us that story.
Yeah. Well, in 1937, Pippin was represented by two paintings in the Chester County Art Association annual exhibition. Christian Britton was the organizer of the exhibition. He had placed the paintings, apparently, in a position that wasn't real prominent. This is how the story has been told to us. And NC came and he was judging the exhibition. He suggested that they be moved to a more prominent place. The thought is that perhaps Brinton had them less prominently shown because he was the first African-American painter to be shown there, and he was, I guess, worried that there would be negative reaction to it. So anyway, NC gave him an honorable mention, and after that point, his rise was almost meteoric. A year later, he was showing at the Museum of Modern Art, and then he gained the attention of a dealer in Philadelphia, Robert Carlin, who began to represent him. Albert Barnes came to know him, and from then on, he was exhibiting nationally, New York, Chicago, San Francisco.
And for those who aren't aware, Christian Britton, yes, that you mentioned?
Sure. Christian Britton was an art critic. He was based in Chatsford, and he was also a collector of modern art, a very well-known collection that eventually went to the Philadelphia Museum of Art.
You mentioned one of Pippin's first patrons was Albert Barnes. What did Barnes see in Pippin's work?
What Barnes saw was something that really appealed to him, and that was that Pippin was self-taught, considered a primitive artist. At the time, that was the term used. We don't use that anymore, but basically it meant he was self-taught, that he was an artist who reduced form to its essentials and worked in a more flat style in terms of perspective and composition. Barnes likened that to what he called Negro spirituals. He thought there was an affinity with that and something that he admired both in music and in art. Also, Barnes collected work from Africa, African art, and he saw an affinity with that as well. So he found in Pippin what he called an authentic American artist because he thought he was pure. That was his definition of Pippin, you know, pure innocence, which we look at very differently now. We see Pippin as much more sophisticated than, well, how he was portrayed in his lifetime.
Right. You mentioned we don't use the word primitive anymore. Sometimes it's called folk art, but Pippin himself would not have called himself that. He would have called himself perhaps a realist.
Right. He considered himself to be portraying reality as he saw it, he said, as it really is and now as he saw it. He didn't label himself in any way, and he didn't want to be labeled in that way. Basically, the folk art term stuck with him for a couple years, but he was still absorbed into the mainstream of American art and was exhibiting, like, as I said, across the country, still being referred to as a primitive or naive artist. But today he would be considered a narrative painter, or even under the rubric of modernism, because his art has affinities with modern artists in terms of the reduction of form, the flatness, the simplicity, the boldness of color. He fits into that category as well.
In the town of Westchester, as you mentioned, and its surrounding areas appear often in Pippin's work, and harmonizing an oil on canvas from 1944 certainly is one of the more popular images that we associate with Horace Pippin.
Yes, and in it we see four singers, four young men on a street corner singing a cappella style, and it's very wonderful composition in terms of the organization of the forms and color, but it's also a very kind of tender scene, camaraderie, and you see the men singing together. Below them on the street is what we think a shoeshine kit. So Pippin always added these little details that added to the interest of the painting. But what's really compelling about it is the color, the bright colors of the men's clothing against the back of the fence, which is this wonderful wood grain that Pippin was really drawn to, and he really spent a lot of time on these details.
In the gallery, there are paintings, his war paintings, memories of war. World War I, of course, had a profound effect on him, both as a man and as an artist. He actually said in a letter that he wrote to a friend that the war brought out the art in me.
Yes, and he also said he would never forget suffering and never forget sunset. So he came home with all that in his mind, and he said, I paint from it today. I mentioned earlier that he had created a memoir after returning from the war, and we are lucky enough to have that in the exhibition. We can only show one page at a time, but we do have a video screen showing other pages. It's fascinating reading, and you can find the whole memoir online at the Archives of American Art, but we do have this in the gallery. It gives a really detailed narrative of everyday experience in the war, the really hard part of it, the everyday cold, the chill, the loss of life. And in the paintings that he created related to it, we really get a sense of life in the trenches. There's one in particular that is a combat painting, and that is called The End of the War, Starting Home. And it is one of his earliest paintings. In fact, it may be his earliest painting. He created it for over 3 years. And it really shows not only the process that he was learning, but it also shows the chaos of war. And he creates in the sky fire planes being blown up and falling to the ground. And that illuminates what's happening below. We see the white German soldiers retreating and surrendering to the black soldiers who are seen in the foreground. Now, Pippin was part of this regiment called the 369th Regiment. That was an all-African-American troop. And they went over to France and fought heroically, became known as the Harlem Hellfighters. So you see them in the painting, and there's one figure that is really not very visible, but I think that when people come, they should try to find it. On the right-hand side of the painting, you see a figure laying prone with blood at his neck, and that is representing a dead soldier, something that hadn't been portrayed very often in retelling of World War I. African-American experience is being studied more now than ever before, and in fact, we're going to have a lecture on that very subject in June.
In the exhibition here at the Brandywine River Museum as well. Significant that you have a self-portrait, because there's actually only two known self-portraits of Horace Pippin, and here's one right here.
Yes. Unfortunately, we were not able to borrow the other one, but we're so pleased to have this one. It's a very intimate portrait of him, very expressive in brushstroke and in the feeling that it conveys, which is of an artist who's very confident, I believe, in himself and really has a belief in his own vision, which is how I've begun to see Pippin throughout this exhibition planning process. He was an artist who, although is considered in the past as isolated and maybe perhaps separated from the art world, he really knew art, and he studied by visiting museums, and also he had visited the Barnes Foundation. So he was not this artist who was so isolated that he wasn't aware of what was happening in the art world. And I think we see that in his work as we look more closely at it. But the self-portrait to me is really one of my favorite parts of the exhibition, because it's so tender and almost intimate portrayal of himself.
There was an exhibit in Pennsylvania in 1994, and the curator, Judith Stein, said he knew he was good.
Yes, she's absolutely right. And what a great exhibition that was. We've sort of built on that foundation for this exhibition. Yes, he knew he was good. In fact, that's where we got the title of the exhibition. He had said to another painter, Edward Loper, another painter, "Do you know what makes me great, Ed?" And it said, "No, I'd love to hear it." And Pippin said, "I paint things exactly the way they are and the way I see them." So I think that is really telling of him, not only as an artist, but as a man. He saw things the way they were, and he was true to himself in painting them. He said, if an artist knows hard times, he should paint them as well. So I thought that was very telling.
What do you think Horace Pippin's legacy is?
Well, I think that Pippin was an important artist for a number of reasons. Jacob Lawrence, who was more or less Pippin's contemporary, but painted beyond Pippin, because Pippin died in 1946, saw Pippin as a role model in terms of his subject matter and his persistence at painting and his persistence to keep his own vision. We see scenes of the war, we see scenes of racism, we see social commentary on other issues such as slavery and religion. And I think that all of those things are still relevant today and in this world. And for that reason, I think Pippin will resonate with today's audiences.
Our thanks to Audrey Lewis, Associate Curator at the Brandywine River Museum of Art. Horace Pippin, The Way I See It, runs at the Brandywine River Museum of Art through July 29th. For more information, visit brandywinemuseum.org. Next on The Green, Enlighten Me, and an update on the Rehoboth Art League's expansion. Stay with us. This is Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green. I'm Tom Byrne. This week's Enlighten Me takes us to Sussex County and the Rehoboth Art League, which is expanding its footprint. The league was founded 77 years ago in a two-room studio in what was an 18th-century farmhouse in Henlopen Acres on the edge of Rehoboth Beach. Today, the main campus is a four-acre wooded oasis surrounded by upscale homes. But the Art League is no longer limited to just its birthplace. Tourists driving on Route 9 toward Five Points will see the banner for the Rehoboth Art League Studios, the organization's first long-term satellite location. Contributor Pam George recently sat down with the Art League's executive director, Sheila Bravo, to discuss the expansion and how it will affect the organization's role in the community.
Strategically, one of the important goals for us was to help make our programs more accessible to the community, to artists, and to students. And that That translates into a variety of ways. That includes physical changes to our campus for accessibility, but also the location of where we held our programs. We've been offering scholarships to kids for years, but many of them don't take advantage of it because they couldn't get to the Acres. We know in the summertime, the heavy beach traffic can dissuade folks from wanting to visit us. And our ability to offer new programming has been limited because we have, at the Henlopen Acres, historic buildings. And if you want to preserve your historic buildings, you can't really change them that much. And so for us to be able to grow and to meet the needs of the community, we needed to reach out beyond Henlopen Acres.
I think we should let folks know who have not been to the Art League before, who possibly have not heard of it, although we can't imagine, the situation that the Art League is within the town of Henlopen Acres.
Yes, the Art League was founded 77 years ago in what was a residential community founded by Colonel Wilbur Corcoran and his wife, Louise Chambers Corcoran. And they always had a vision for it to be a place for cultured people. In fact, they formed the Art League right next to where they live. And over the years, over the decades, homes were built up around that area. So the Art League is about 4 acres right in the heart of Henlopen Acres. And so it's ability to really change and grow is hampered by that, because it's important not only to the Art League but also to the community to retain the character of the town. And so that's what I meant about growth in our historic buildings. We weren't really able to adapt them the way that we'd want to for the future. By expanding to a new location, it gives us that opportunity to do so.
How do you see this impacting tourism? Adding to it, one more place folks can go?
Absolutely. It's proven that the arts are an economic driver to the community, and particularly the Rehoboth Art League has for many years been a destination for people. Our fabulous cottage tour, which is held in July, the annual fine art outdoor show, which is held in August, people plan their vacations around them. And as this community continues to draw tourists and visitors, we believe the Art League will be one other location that they can visit, not only in Henlopen Acres, but here. And I should say that one thing we learned with the annex on Rehoboth Avenue when we were there was that people who had not ever heard of the Rehoboth Art League learned about us and then went to visit our historic campus. So it really served not only as a venue for us to try some new things, but also as a bit of a marketing tool. I don't think that the events that we've traditionally done in Henlopen Acres will change their location anytime soon. Some of the character of those events is because of where they're located. However, the developers, when we talked to them about our moving here, were very excited because they're building a community and they would hope that we would be able to do some community events here as well.
The Art League has quite an extensive collection that the last time I visited was in the attic of the homestead. Is there any place here for that?
There certainly will always be an opportunity for us to exhibit works from our collection here as well as other locations. We currently loan it to some locations. For example, Senator Coon's office in D.C. has works from the Art League collection. Buena Vista has works. We would like to have exhibition space that would be dedicated to promoting the collection on a regular basis. Right now at our Henlopen Acres campus, we have created a small gallery that is has a rotation of the works from the collection. And we have recently completed a climate-controlled storage space just for the collection that will ensure that they endure for decades to come. Some of the works are nearly 100 years old because they are from artists who founded the Art League back in the 1930s, and so that includes students of Howard Pyle. In fact, because Howard Pyle's students were founders of the Rehoboth Art League, we have works of Howard Pyle in our collection, as well as other artists from the Brandywine movement, and we are continuing to collect. So it was important for us to be able to have a space that would be dedicated to preserving the collection, and then from there we continue to receive gifts that only enhance it.
Is that on the campus or is that offsite?
It's on the Henlopen Acres campus. That's actually we had a building that predates the 1900s, at least from photographic archives, and we call it the stables. It was probably used for many things given that the Art League's property used to be an old farm. And it needed desperate restoration. And so we thought, why not restore the building and use it for storage, but climate control in a way that it could also store art.
Any other plans for improvements on the main campus?
When we announced that we were moving into the space, we also unveiled that we had completed a master campus plan for the Henlopen Acres area. And the vision is to preserve the character of that campus, but continue to upgrade it and enhance it for contemporary expectations such as accessibility, climate control. And so we are now in conversations with our neighbors and folks who live in the Acres, because we want to ensure that we've tried to address a lot of their concerns, things such as having plantings in a way that somebody whose property might be next door to the Acre or to the Art League won't have to see the cars, for example, at night. So we've tried to address a lot of those concerns in our campus plan, but it's going to take us a couple of years to implement it because it includes improving the parking and stormwater drainage issues and outdoor lighting and a lot of big projects that we'll need to raise money for.
Is the state helping at all with this effort?
The state has been very instrumental. We signed in 2009 an affiliation agreement with the Division of Historical and Cultural Affairs. And so Tim Slavin, who's the director, his staff has been very helpful in helping us plan and understanding, particularly on the historic preservation part, what are the parameters. And we've even had the benefit of some of their staff working with us with the collection in our gardens. And so certainly with the master campus plan, they were instrumental in advising us in some of that.
So what's next for the Art League? What would you like to see in the next 5 years, 10 years?
Well, the space here is a 5-year lease. So part of our exploration will be to understand how the organization grows and evolves with the two locations. I would hope in the next 5 years we would implement the master campus plan. I think that it's very exciting to be able to take that beautiful property and enhance it so that parking is better and that we've improved the lighting and certainly for interior climate conditions so that our collection can be on exhibit on a routine basis.
Thanks to contributor Pam George and Rehoboth Art League Executive Director Sheila Bravo for enlightening us this week. Pam's full story on the Rehoboth Art League is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And that's a wrap on this week's edition of The Green. A reminder, these stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. If you have thoughts on this week's show or story ideas for future shows, you can contact us via our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributors Pam George and Larry Nagengast, Delaware Public Media's Eli Chen, Kathy Carter, Ann Hoffman, and Carl Malgiro, as well as our station manager, Casey House. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne. Thanks so much for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.